Stephanie Burt, poet and poetry critic extraordinaire. It's my honor to introduce you to The Warehouse, and I'm very grateful to introduce The Warehouse to you this evening. We're thrilled to have you here. I've written so far four versions of this introduction. The first emphasized the rich philosophical underpinnings between Burt's four books of poetry. The second attempted to introduce two of the most salient through lines in her most recent book. The third basically consisted of me reading Burt's poems for her. I don't know how to introduce a poet whose body of work is so rich and so easy to celebrate. Stephanie Burt's poems demand rereading. Not for any syntactical obscurity, but for the complex and complicating joy that it is to see the world through the perspective she endows in her speakers. These speakers may be insects, or they may be owls. At times, we enter the world as seen by a kite, by a secondhand flashlight. We observe the universe through an imagined childhood, that of the Stephanie poems, and through the poet's own recounted memories of her actual lived childhood. We study the stars in an astronomy globe, and then there's Taylor Swift, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, an Alexandrian poet. The fact that these many surfaces of the world appear so cogently in four unassuming books is frankly beyond my reckoning. Steph Burt spins from the everyday something extraordinary at each turn of the page. One leaves the experience of reading her four books with the feeling, rooted as much in the mind as in the heart, that the universe is somehow different now, somehow painted with a finer grain of dye, more haunting and disturbed than before, yes, but also dancing, a universe that also dances despite itself. And then wait. And then one pauses to check the joy of dancing, these poems prompt with the warnings they proclaimed. Advice from the Lights, the title of Burt's most recent book, warns against the assurance of any beacon, betrays the reader who would look to it for guidance. And this is perhaps these poems' greatest turn. They sing from and of themselves and call us to do the same. These are poems that have gained purchase on the page only through the same reckoning powers that shaped and resized the bodies they display boldly with an assurance that increases with each selection published. And isn't that another definition for humility? Not to boast or to pander, but to know and to assert oneself for one's own size and shape in the world. And to witness as these shapes and sizes change, those of the self, those of the world, and still somehow to know oneself, to never stop asking who. Who am I and we? Who are we? And what can we become as together as we are alone while still there is time? Stephanie Burt is a poet, literary critic, and professor. In 2012, the New York Times called Burt one of the most influential poetry critics of her generation. Burt grew up around Washington, D.C., and earned a B.A. from Harvard and a Ph.D. from Yale. She has published four collections of poems, Popular Music, Parallel Play, Belmont, and Advice from the Lights, her most recent. Burt's works of criticism include The Poem Is You, 60 Contemporary American Poems and How to Read Them, Close Calls with Nonsense, Reading New Poetry, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, The Art of the Sonnet, written with David Mikix, The Forms of Youth, 20th Century Poetry and Adolescence, Randall Jarrell on W.H. Auden with Hannah Brooks' model and Randall Jarrell and His Age. Burt has taught at McAllister College and is now professor of English at Harvard University. She lives in the suburbs of Boston with her spouse, Jesse Bennett, and their two children. Please join me in giving an unrelenting welcome to tonight's reader, Dr. Stephanie Burt.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you, Andrew and Keith and Aaron and the FSU program and the Roadhouse staff who will be serving some of us beers and other things afterwards. And also the booksellers who are here. Where are the booksellers? Are they here? Back there. Thank you. Yeah, without booksellers, it would be a lot harder to write books. And publishers, no. Wow. Zach, you just described the poet I've always wanted to be, and I hope I'm her, and it never gets old to hear that I am her already, but it's also like, I hope you're not all disappointed. So I'm gonna read some brand new stuff to start the evening, and then I will go into the book that took a while to write, but it all still feels kind of new. And I'm told we never do Q&A because this is a place of entertainment. more, you know, delights rather than instructs. But it often happens that people will have things to say about individual poems, and I want to be sure that you extra know that I'll be hanging out after the reading. And any, if you're here giving me 35 minutes of your attention, I'm very happy to answer any questions you might have. I just won't do it on stage. Right? Right. Yeah. Wow. This is fun. When we were in New Zealand about a year ago, and it got me thinking about kinds of poetry that get written in New Zealand, especially about a poet called Jenny Bornholt, who is very, very understated. You read her and you're like, were those lines broken at random? And they're very short lines too. And then you start reading her recent work, which is the most interesting work, and then you say, oh, now I see. Now I see the understatement and the anticlimax. And it's a little like Stanley Kunitz, but it's not really. It's not like anything we have. So we came back and we went on a whale watch with our kids and my in-laws. And I started to write poems that were influenced by being in this country that was all islands and that was very sensitive to what the future is going to be like as islands change shape and the oceans change shape. And I wrote three poems called Whale Watch. And this is one of them, and it's, I'll just say it's not what you think. You might be surprised as you realize something about the poem. Whale Watch. If you approach the surface calmly and early enough on a breezy day like today, you might see them go by. Long ago, they would stay for hours in their huge metallic shells with fin-sized bolts, some trailing chains as thick as an estuary eel. They would gather at the tip of each of their shells and look out as if to say goodbye to a wave or to a cloud, or to ice, which your great aunt may still remember. Now all their shelves are made from bones of fallen trees. For steering and propulsion, they carve branches, which they dip into the sea, then pull back, two at a time, like so. Sometimes they grunt or hiss while propelling themselves, almost as we do when we begin to grieve. The woven grids they keep affixed to the largest shells work like baleen, although much coarser. They secure sea grapes, sea lettuce, kelp, and bladder wrack, the basis of their diet, which they augment with herring or capelin. Take care not to swim too fast or rise too close. Some shells flip over easily, and their ability to dive is surprisingly limited, although it varies considerably. They cannot hurt us, though long ago they could. If you stay nearly silent long enough, you might be able to hear their chirps and specks, a work song, perhaps, or one of the greetings or warnings they emit at the upper limit of our hearing. Your calves will likely have more luck than you. Okay, we were talking at dinner about science fiction and science fiction poetry. I don't know if that's science fiction poetry or not, but it's certainly set in the future. This one comes from the past, and the title is a pun. Impatiens, with an S. You guys know what those are, right? Yeah. Do they, is this, are there like gardeners here? Is this too far south for them? No? No, you got them? You just, okay. Yeah, me, no, I really am them, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what this poem is about. Impatience. Petals that flourish in shade, the deeper the better. They treat the sun much as we treat the sun, a friend as long as we don't have to see his face. Indigo, moth wing, beetle carapace blue. They were the single flower or flower name that stuck in my mind after our mother decided we ought to try gardening together. My brothers and I needed to get dirt on our grade school hands. The resulting muddy fingerprints were temporarily everywhere indoors. The mature blooms can lay across each other casually, like couples in high school hallways, or else in late middle age. Once settled in their shallow excavations and properly sheltered from overexposure, they can almost be left alone. An uninformed visitor, seeing the shapes they make in their raised wooden beds, could take them for pansies, though they are more resistant to winter and never display anything like a face. No matter what choices you make, you will entertain second thoughts. You could always have run away or grown some other way. Who do you want to be before you die?
Oh. Oh.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you like it. I really thought that, like, queer and trans inanimate objects, like, how many of them can you find? But it turns out there are a lot more of us out there than I thought. It's nice. I think I'm going to do two more new poems and then just go to the book. I'm taking a huge risk with what I think is a sophisticated crowd and reading something that I'm pretty sure is finished. I'm not sure. You're not going to hear the pattern because it's in syllabics, unless you do hear it. And what you need to know. Oh, the only thing you need to know going in is that it is. We all know who Howard Stern is, right? Still, like terrible, gross human, like commercially successful national radio DJ, lots of hair, ooh. So it's good to know going in that before he did that sort of nationally and sort of enabled all kinds of things that shouldn't happen, he was the, and in the era when terrestrial radio was a much bigger thing, Andrew, you know this, he was a very big deal local DJ, and the local DJ market that he was a very big deal in was Washington, D.C. I think everything else that's technical is explained in the poem. Tin Pest, and the title runs into the poem. Tin Pest is autocatalysis, in which the first dull bit of a frangible, softer, metallic allotrope emerging at near freezing temperatures can induce the rest of the tin in an alloy to follow suit until, for example, the solder that keeps each jar and can able to hold water crumbles away, as may have happened to Napoleon's legions, starving on their katabatic step. More generally, touching or even approaching some things initiates feedback, where more begets more of the same. You laugh so hard you pee yourself, which is funny, so you pee more. Or cooties. When I believed that I was the second least popular kid in fifth grade, I swore to stay far from Darren, the true essence of dork, dirt crescents under his lengthy nails and, rumor said, lice in his hair, whose tight, cruel curls grew back into his ears. Matte and coarse to the touch, affected tin turns a vicious vitiligo white, flaking off as it clings to your palms, your knuckles, and the ridges of fingerprints, as if to illustrate what we recited in Spanish. Mejor solo que mal acompañado. Better alone than in bad company, as in Bad Company, whose song kicked ass on DC 101, whose new DJ Howard Stern boys quoted verbatim. All those hot chicks, all that costly signaling between wicked Fender solos, all those young dudes with the hands down their own pants. Follow the leader without any leader is musical chairs, our new teacher's analogy for the shifting electrons in rot or rust. Stern's successor named himself the Grease Man. Boys loved him till May, when their thoughts turned to razors. Girls reapplied lip gloss and apple red, cut their bangs asymmetrically, and all took notes on Q107's top 5 at 10. The unattainable goals and hip-shaking beat to Blondie's Call Me scared me. Instead, I chose to copy down the words to XTC's sarcastic new wave hit, whose reverb-heavy chorus explained, "Generals and majors, are never too far from battlefields so glorious." Yeah. The sort of subtext of that poem is like when people think that you're a boy for a long time and you're not and you never have been and you think that groups of boys are terrifying and militarized and horrible. You figure maybe like after you come out, you'll figure out whether they're still horrible or it was just you. And I still don't know. I still don't know. And it's scary because we're raising one and like he'll be fine. I think I'm going to read some short poems. Apologies to those of you who were promised a long narrative poem that was adapted from ancient Greek, maybe. Yeah. My 1979. I was Mr. Spock being raised by Dr. Spock. I was told I was free, but only free to be me. I knew I loved my digital clock. I would have trusted my instincts if I had any, or if I could have given them a name. I was deceived by the body that I mistook for a bad penny, by the shimmery beauty of my immediate peers, which I mistook for fame, by wearing them over and over without socks. I let my one pair of gold tennis shoes fall apart. I regarded the temporary reassembly of the styrofoam packing parts that came with small household appliances as a fine art. Inhabited by C-3POs, they became star bases or soft-focus all-white homes of the future. I wanted to think that they had nothing to fear. I ate peanut butter and pimento sandwiches every day for at least a week. This is true. At most, for half a year. I had become convinced that character was fate. Almost anything could result in tears. I wanted to stay at Allison's house overnight and wake up as a new girl, or a new mutant, or a new kind of humanity, engineered to travel at more than half the speed of light. But I wasn't allowed. My bedtime and I were both 8.
Oh. Oh.
Man. I used to be terrified to read that poem in public, and now I really enjoy it. Thank you for your support. It also contains a comic book continuity mistake, which I will say, like, no one has ever pointed out the comic book continuity mistake. And if you catch it, I will send you something really cool in the mail. Andrew, did you catch it? No, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, but why is that a mistake? That is correct. New Mutants number one appears 2 years later. You are good. You are good. Yeah. I think it's 81 or 82 that New Mutants number one happens. Wow. Send me your address and you'll get something cool in the mail. I'm serious. Wow. Okay, this is now my favorite reading ever. Okay. Where do you go from there, though? Like,
more prizes.
What?
More prizes.
Will you supply the prizes?
Sure.
Yeah. No, my graduate students now know that I care about sort of mutants and have started giving me like semi-collectible like old X-Men stuff in bags, which means that there's part of a wall in my office that has sort of a line of them, thumbtacked to the wall, and it feels like my office now. It's great. But seriously, send me your address, and you will get something cool in the mail. But this is so X-Men, as you may know, is full of characters and situations that serve really well as allegories for queer and trans identity. I can't quite do what they did in the 80s and what they're doing, by the way, again. It's good again, really. It was terrible in the 90s. But I partly through thinking about what you can do with superhero comics and partly through reading Elizabeth Bishop sort of obsessively, I started to think about just how to make objects and identities and characters who were not realistic and not me and exist in a simplified world speak about what we are now pleased to call identity and stigmatized identity and, trans identity in particular. So there are a couple animals and talking objects in here that are really about something else. There are swans who are really ways of thinking about parenthood, for example, and they could be trans, but mostly they're just like trying to raise kids by an airport. But most of the talking objects and insects and stuff in here, roly-poly bug. Because I can't ever appear as I would like to appear, I once tried to make it so you couldn't see me at all. I named myself after a pill, but it didn't help. I liked the feeling of feeling small, as long as it let me feel mobile. I wanted to roll up and down and around the tiny hall of a groove in discarded cardboard. I used to appall my peers with risky behavior. I might fall to my death in a half-inch ditch full of oil or lawnmower grease. Excuse me. I stall at the brush of a fingertip. I'm so afraid of a grand faux pas that I answer the most banal questions by quoting the questioner so as to let his words shield mine. I cover my anger imperfectly so I can breathe with my head between my 10 legs. I am my own backyard slat fence, my own slate garden wall. I am chitin and ichor inside, but I'll never let on how I look underneath. I could always make something else of myself. I could be having a ball. Thank you. A bunch more, right? You think, yeah. Yeah. You only have to see one poet like read way longer than expected to fear doing that for the rest of your life. So I think I'll do one or two more of the like real life childhood nostalgia memory things. Are there prog rock people in here? Okay. Yeah. Do you guys know who Dave Weigel is? Yeah, okay. Should I say? Okay, so this is a lead into the poem, but it doesn't really have to do with queer or trans anything. Dave Weigel is a reporter. He's a political writer and a very talented one who spent 2016 covering the disaster that was American public life in 2016. And usually when that's your day job, you cash in by writing a book about like how Hillary lost or like why we should all be involved in local elections and vote every time and like what the heck is wrong in D.C. Also, like, you guys have this initiative to give people back their voting rights, right? Yeah. That's going to be on the ballot? It's on the ballot. Yeah, that's not having it pass. Most initiatives lose, right?
Yeah, but it got on the ballot.
I heard, yeah. No, that's amazing news. That's really exciting. Yeah, like, I love doing this. Like, I love poetry, but I really am a pastry chef, right? Pastry is great. Like, dessert is great. The things that we need to do to keep having a country, like, are things like collecting signatures and making sure that your neighbors vote in local elections. We may now return to, you know, poetry. Yeah, but so Dave Weigel does this all year, and instead of writing a What the Campaign Was Like book, because that sucked and he didn't want to relive it in any way, wrote a book about like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and like Yes, and Rush, and all of the least fashionable bands that he was really into when he was 10, and I was 10, and he went around the country interviewing the people who were still really, really into them and have organized their lives around prog rock. And I haven't read the book, but I've read excerpts, and I want you to know what it is, because it's sort of the... I'm sure it speaks in some oblique way to this poem. My 1982. I had a future in the dark. At Putt-Putt Mini Golf Arcade and Recreation Park, I stood up and twitched as if in lab's fume hoods. Divorced, like other seventh graders' parents, both from evil and from good. I had to stop to pee, pull up my pants, or unpick grit from a trackball. Some games relied, like social life, on patterns. Remember each action and its consequence, and you would never get killed or fail or fall. Others demanded adrenaline, norepinephrine, alertness fit for national defense. At home, I kept trying and failing to play piano parts for Roundabout and Long Distance Runaround, whose singer's futuristic poise, high A, and strenuous facade of confidence seemed to mean he belonged to the heavens, where there would be no difference between the voices of girls and men. I wanted to sing about C, about optimization, about hypergolic propellants and hydrazine, the histories of rocketry and electricity from Amber to Goddard by way of Leyden jars. My panoply of inappropriate postures included the extreme slouch and the backward lean, accomplished out of overcompensation and a wish to look as if I were watching the stars. This came up at dinner. My favorite poet of classical antiquity is a poet called Callimachus, who's probably not the librarian at the Library of Alexandria, but like hung out with those people and was very well read and very conscious of like not being the macho writer of an epic that inaugurated a tradition and founded a nation. He didn't do that. He sort of made fun of people who wanted to do that. He was famous for saying, mega biblion, mega kakon, which means a big book is a great evil. My friend Mark Payne, who's a terrific classicist at the University of Chicago, has written essays that say, and I'm going to paraphrase him very, very loosely, this is a terrific, like, quiet, studious, childlike, very queer poet of late antiquity. Why is he not influential in English when people like go up and down about Horace and Sappho and Ovid? So I tried to fix that. After Callimachus, half of me, an intangible half, is alive. The other part has gone, I don't know where. Either it's dead or it's lost in what it calls love. Actually, it's a flighty tween delighted by jelly shoes. Keep your eyes on the printed page. Stop playing with your hair, I tell her, and put down your portable screen. No use. I'm supposed to profess that maturity is a gift, but I don't believe it, or else I don't care. I amble the library stacks and get lost in YA. I want to go home, paint my nails until they iridesce, clamp on my headphones, and pray to Taylor Swift. I think I wouldn't, like, you should pray to Taylor Swift because she won't denounce her Nazi fans, which is weird. Although she's done a lot of other things right. But I think I wouldn't, that's one of the few poems in here that I read and I feel like I wouldn't have written that today because there's a certain amount of, like, shame that comes with liking low-prestige cultural objects. And that's, you know, it runs very deep, at least if you're over a certain age, and it's terrible. And I like the high-prestige cultural objects I liked 10 years ago just as much. I like Marianne Moore's poetry a lot more. But no one should be ashamed of liking what they like. Thank you. Yeah, no. Like, this came up at dinner, too, right? Your job, if you're a teacher, is not to get your students to stop liking things that you think are bad. Although it may be to get them to abandon the value systems that come with those things if the things are, for example, militaristic or sexist. It's to get your students to see what's valuable in the stuff that you value, right? And if you say no, you have to start hating E.E. Cummings. Like, that's not going to help, right? And it's a rare example of someone I used to like who I really don't like. Rare example, but if you know, don't tell someone to stop liking what they like. Don't do that. Cicadas. They want it to be the same thing to be born and to turn 17. See how long they waited, how similar they are to what they were. Stridulation is an educational name for their repetitive song that does not sound to outsiders like music at all. Litterbugs, shutterbugs, clicking practitioners of non-attachment to what was their skin and their clothes. It took such time before they could look you in the eye and make an impression beyond the asynchronous husk or mask of what they used to be. As you sweep the rest of them off the hood and front of your car, your porch, hat brim, etc., remember why they can't help but leave these hollow parts that were not so much theirs as them. We are already done. It wasn't fair. We will bury ourselves again after our one ride through your duplicitous temperate air. That was a scary one. A couple more? Yeah. I've never read this one in public before, and it's not obviously personal, except it kind of is. It's one of two elegies for individuals who art was important to me, who died while I was writing this book. Yeah, I can read this. Sadder. Honor existing commitments, but don't make any new ones. That is what my mirror image said to me. The one in the passenger side, sun visor's fold-out mirror that never sleeps. If you hold to the highest standard, everything people have made, eventually, you will love only unimproved nature, says the corrosive breeze. And wish fulfillment is the hidden goal of every poem, except when it is the obvious goal, in which case the hidden goal is something like learn how to live in this world. Whatever matters cannot be created, says the false harbor, though it can be easily destroyed. Oh, sad-hatted midday pedestrians in nearly frozen air on the two-lane road before the ocean in Barrington, where the sea-wind-tolerant shrubs encroach and industry never was, and nothing is sweet and everything is salt, and the author of Stringlight and Shallcross no longer has your back. Each grain could be the last in an arc whose end we know, and all the far whitecaps are rescue hounds who want to run as fast as they were once rewarded for running and will not run, or not with such enthusiasm, not ever again. Some of you know who that was about, and the rest of you should, because, anyone? Yes, thank you, yeah. Yeah, you should all go home and read the things that C.D. Wright wrote. If you don't know where to start with a book called Tremble, and just keep going. She's, I mean, if you have to pick one poet who, from the late 20th century, who, like, the 22nd century is going to be reading, that's an impossible task, and I hope more than one of us survive. But if you have to pick one, C.D. Wright is not a bad choice. Advice or prayer for airports. There are no lords. We should protect one another. Let the technology work until it fails, until it is free to rust. Let each pixel and tap on the shoulder show us where we cannot stay, where someone else needs the fee. Let us be like the insects that ride in droplets from one habitat to another, bromeliad dwellers, trumpet, resilient tears. Two more seem right? Two more or three more?
Three?
Okay. So if you actually are following X-Men comics, you may be aware not only that Wolverine was an old guy called Logan, and he's still in the comics, but it's a different version who's just called Logan, because Wolverine is a 20-something girl with a real young woman who we first met as a girl with a terrible past named Laura, who now has to take care of two even younger Wolverines, one of whom is a grade schooler called Gabby, and one of whom is an actual Wolverine. It's great. And people who write about X-Men and don't really look things up think that Wolverines are wolves, and they're not. They're also not ferrets. That was my segue. This poem is called Spoken for a Pair of Ferrets, and it's actually about my kids fighting all the time. Too serious no longer, we have learned to love our restlessness, whose tussles left us short of breath. We wrestled with the reckless flesh that both of us would test and test, then half refresh and half forget to use what's left in each of us, vitality we live to spend, to roll, unroll, and revel in our toothed excess of wildness. Would in the wild be what it took to nose fresh eggs past lips of nest, or drag mole rats from burrows. Where we live determines what we do, how frivolous or violent we have to be. Captivity thus keeps us fresh. Our arguments are circular. We love to writhe, to form a wreath or flare and tie ourselves in knots like rope walks nets. Come play with us, we say, except you can't. Wrong head and body shape, wrong tibias and scapulas. If we invite you anyway, it's just to tease you for your lack of torque, your inabilities, refusing the imperative to work hard or make more of us. Our nature is evading nature's laws, all over each other or always on each other's backs with half retracted claws. Okay. So some of this stuff was in The earliest of these poems, some of them were in a chapbook that Rain Taxi Editions did a couple of years ago. And if you're not reading Rain Taxi, which is also online, consider it. They're a book review magazine that's very hospitable to early career critics and reviewers. And I think I should read one of those poems, and then maybe The Flashlight. Fairy story, Stephanie. After I pricked myself in my ring finger deliberately with a pin, because I wanted to feel something in my own body that I had done on my own, I couldn't sleep for a week or not for more than an hour at a time. I was the sun in June. I was ready to set all amber and solar gel and me craving the lead. I want to be found, but I wanted to be hard to find. I have the longest lashes and the least patience. And if strangers admire my powers, I won't mind having to stand forever waiting in line. I stole a shiny cylinder of cucumber lip gloss from the CVS, a serpent's tooth from the leaves of our beech tree. Until recently, I could not tell any difference between I want to meet people like me, I want people to like me, and I want to go out of my way to meet people like me, except that I want there to be nobody like me, only a mirror in air and a series of shimmery alien sympathies. Thank you for all the time that you and your friends let me pay attention to me paying attention to me. I think I promised one more at short. Yeah? I try to keep my promises. And, like, thank you so much for being here. And, you know, I hope, you know, support one another, right? Don't just, like, support, I don't know, me. I am doing a scholarly talk where I'll talk about other poets and sort of give back to the other things I've been reading lately tomorrow. Should I announce that, Andrew?
Tomorrow at 3:30.
Tomorrow at 3:30 in a building. What building? In the Williams. Is it named for William Carlos Williams?
No, I wish.
Okay, can we pretend?
Yes.
Okay. Princess Stephanie. To be delicate. To be too big for the helpless. Too little and too important. To have to say, help me out of this tulle dress. I know how to kiss, but not how to do this slow dance. What use is the adult world? It doesn't have unicorns. Why can't I wear two different colored shoes?